Hey everyone, welcome to Neighbor Science. Today is about capitalist power, part two.
Hooray!
Part two! Part two. Also known as part do in other languages. I don't know which ones, but some of them.
In Afrikaans, it would be part twee.
Wait, say that again?
Twee.
That's a weird way to say the number two.
Twee.
Oh, but you put a, like a rhotic R at the end? That's weird.
No, there's no R. What R? Twee.
Okay, sure.
See, this is the problem with English, is that you've got such a soft R, whereas in Afrikaans, you've got the rolling R. So, yeah. Like, when there's an R in Afrikaans, you know about it.
Okay. Yeah, so today we're talking about how capitalization is practiced. So last time we talked about capitalization, the pricing of assets based on expected future value, to put it briefly. If you haven't heard that episode, I recommend going back and listening to it. I don't remember what number it is, but you know it says it in the title. So you can also go on the Post-Scarcity Magazine site and look up podcasts by tag, and then just click the Capitalist Power tag, and it'll have all of the episodes where we talk about capitalist power. So today... go ahead.
Just wanted to mention to everyone, Ryan puts a lot of effort into the Capitalist Power episodes, does a lot of research that I struggle to keep up with it. Go back to the last one. It was like four episodes ago. No, three, four. We've done... The Zuckerberg, the My Hero Academia,
And then lost. And the news,
We did the news. Four ago, check it out.
Yeah, that's why we have so many news and anime episodes, is because it takes so much research that, you know, I don't have time, I don't feel like it, it just takes long. So this one, I think, will be even better than the last one. I think the last one we struggled to fill the full time, but this time I think we'll probably have to cut some stuff down. So if you want to hear the stuff that we end up taking out, you can go on our Patreon, and I'll have to get better about posting up the outtakes. I have them all saved. I just have to like put them all together, put them in a track, and then throw them up on Patreon. But if you donate at any level, you'll be able to hear the outtakes that I put up there. And I don't know if we'll ever have time to do bonus episodes. That seems like too much for us.
Yeah, we're. Although I suppose since we've been very diligent about recording on a weekly basis and posting on a weekly basis, I'm starting to feel like our adhocracy episode is never going to make it on air. So maybe that's one that's worth just quickly stitching up and putting
well
up on Patreon.
If you're starting a new job soon, so we might have to miss a week, so maybe we'll put it up then.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
Anyway.
Okay. So,
yeah, let's get
capital
into it.
As power, and today we're looking at how capitalization is practiced.
Yep. So, once again, capitalization is the pricing of an asset based on expected future value, although I think it's more accurate to say future price. To avoid confusing a price value with like value in general, as in like use value, as Marxists would say it, or you know, just the value of something, like subjective value, all that shit.
We're not talking about usufruct or anything like that.
Yeah. And so it's expected future price or expected future revenue. So we want to understand how this is actually used and done in practice. So the basic idea, if we go back to when capitalization first started happening, things were priced, like if you were going to buy a plot of land, you would value that land based on what is currently there. Bickler and Nitzan used the, their classic example is German woodcutters. Apparently in the same forests as like where Marx was born or lived or something like that. There's some weird connection to it. I don't really understand it. But these German woodcutters would value land based on the wood that it would produce in the future. And so this is a subtle but crucial upgrade in strategic accumulation. So rather than thinking of how much wood is now on a piece of land, these woodcutters were thinking about how much wood they could get in the future. Yeah. And I wrote down here, what does it say? How much wood could a woodcutter cut if a woodcutter valued woodlots by how much there would be wood? Huh. That's, wonder what that
which
means.
Is perfect. Yeah, that's awesome. I'm not going to lie. I think that should replace standard woodchuck tongue twister.
Anyway, so yeah, that's the woodcutter example. I have not gone into the primary source for wherever they got that. And there is like a kind of dispute among historians of capitalism about when capitalism really started. So it seems like Bickler and Nitzan have the position that it started in the 13th century, whereas most people would say that it started in the 16th century, I think, is the other position.
Well, look, we are talking about a bit of an unstable time in European history where we were coming out of the Dark Ages and we were transitioning from full-blown feudalism and monarchism into a strange balance of feudalism and mercantilism.
And yeah, when was the really big plague? When did that happen?
Oh, God. Are you talking about the Black Plague?
Yeah.
Why do you make me Google stuff mid-episode? It's like...
I was hoping you would just know it. You know, maybe you learn history better than I do. I don't know. I don't remember dates ever.
Okay, so it was basically 1347 to 1351.
Okay, okay.
So, yeah, basically when most of Europe died, they sort of probably looked at it and said, you know what, we should probably capitalism. And yeah.
That's crazy. I didn't know it was only 4 years. So that was what, a third of the population was wiped out in 4 years. One presidential term.
Yeah, in one presidential term, anywhere from 75 to 200 million people died.
That's crazy.
Which is very similar to what we've seen under Trump so far. So, I mean, it's... Of course, I'm reading directly off Democrat websites, and they're claiming the almost bigger numbers in some cases.
So yeah, traditionalists, if you think feudalism is so great, guess what? It killed 200 million people. So checkmate.
Whoopsie.
Anyway, so today for an example of capitalization, we could use the an example of the price of oil, which is probably the most important price in the global economy. The price of oil influences a lot of other products. It affects the technological landscape. It affects entire national economies because, as a lot of people know, you know, Venezuela, for example, its economy basically lives and dies by the price of oil. So once it dips below a certain level, it's no longer viable for it to export oil, which is where most of its money comes from. And the price of oil also fuels global wars. So as Investopedia explains, the price of oil as we know it is actually set in the oil futures market. An oil futures contract is a binding agreement that gives one the right to purchase oil by the barrel at a predefined price on a predefined date in the future. Under a futures contract, both the buyer and seller are obligated to fulfill their side of the transaction on the specified date. So that's different from an options contract, which is almost exactly the same thing, except the buyer can choose whether or not to buy it in the future.
So it's much closer to, let's say, a government bond than a regular old options contract.
I mean, I don't know how bonds work. My finance knowledge is still at baby level, so I don't really know how a bond works.
Well,
but
a bond.
Right. I don't know.
Yeah. A bond is basically a loan taken out saying that after a specific period of time, that money has to be paid back. And it's a given set amount. And that given set amount is based, obviously, on the number of expected labor numbers that are going to... So like a 20-year maturity bond will say that in 20 years, based on the current rate of population growth and whatnot, we expect that there will be a set number of people working in the economy. And so we expect to be able to get back X amount in taxes from that. And we can then use that amount of tax to pay back this loan. And so that's how bonds are set.
So it's basically capitalizing on tax collection.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a futures contract based on labor taxation.
Yeah. I think futures contracts are more like a year or, you know, a few months.
No, the futures contracts are obviously much shorter term than a government bond. But, I mean, government bonds don't look at 1 or 2 years. They look at 5, 10, and 20 years specifically because of the size of generational gaps.
Yeah.
Whereas capitalism looks at things from year to year because it understands how volatile it makes markets.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay. So some traders of oil futures, representing less than 5% of the contracts, use oil futures contracts to avoid the risk of oil costs suddenly going up. So they'll buy a bunch of futures when the price is at a certain level, if they think that there's the possibility that there will be some shock in the price of oil and it'll make the cost of doing business much higher, so they can guarantee the price at the current level. But the other 95% of oil futures contracts are used to bet on the future price of oil. So the prices paid for oil futures will be based on the buyer expecting the price to increase and on the seller expecting it to decrease. Most articles claim this is based on supply and demand, but if you look at a chart of oil prices versus production, which will be in our show notes, which will be on the website, you'll see that production has only squeaked up while the price has fluctuated wildly and increased significantly overall.
Wildly.
Yeah. It's all not quite as crazy as Bitcoin, but it's pretty up there. And one thing that's really interesting about all the articles that I read about oil futures contracts is that almost, or maybe every article that I read, when they explain what oil futures are, they say that they are used by businesses to avoid risk from oil price changes and are also traded by speculators to make money off of price changes, as if the latter isn't 97% of what they're actually used for.
Interesting. Yeah. It's interesting because it starts to look like speculation in stock markets essentially comes down to the rich people's version of gambling.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Because I mean, technically, that's what these trades are. They're a bet on what's going to happen to a price. And much like I did a very short stint in China over a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, I was bet to participate in various gambles. And one thing I learned...
Were you doing one of those Russian roulette, like backroom things, like in Deer Hunter?
Nothing like dangerous like that, but gambling is a massive part of the way of life for a lot of the lower class Chinese citizens. Or it was when I was there. Obviously, I'm not going to make claims about exactly what it's like now. And one thing that was very interesting is that they're very unwilling to bet unless they have a very, very strong certainty about how things are going to turn out. Mm-hmm. That reminds me a lot of the way I'm perceiving capitalist trading on stock markets when it comes to shorting and all of that. Because at the end of the day, these gambles, I put up in air quotes, are pretty much based on insider information, on understanding how stuff is playing out, how the politics and the political economy landscape is shaped up. And
especially my coworker was explaining high speed trading the other day when we were at lunch, and I've never actually like read about it. I vaguely understood what it was, but he explained it really well, and he was saying that like when someone goes to put in a buy offer for a stock, it'll take that message like say 1 second to travel from their computer to the like stock market computers, like the stock market server or whatever. And these high speed traders have computers that look at the buy offers, and they can respond in say 20 milliseconds. And so when they see that someone is going to buy something, then they know that the price will be going up by whatever amount that it goes up. And so they can arbitrage the price by buying a stock and then selling it really quickly. So they're basically like bleeding the market based on, the knowledge that someone is about to buy something. So that's,
I'm not going to lie. Like, I'm both disgusted and thoroughly impressed by that level of technology being applied to.
And so it's really cool when you think about the possibility of that being used in the oil futures market, which influences the price of everything.
Yeah, very literally everything.
Okay, so back to oil futures. It's really strange to me that, I mean, it's not strange to me. It's like obviously ideological. When anyone is explaining these oil futures, they try to make it as if it's not just about, we expect the price to go up, so we're going to buy an oil future. They try to make it seem like there's some rational purpose, that's used for productive purposes. So the price of oil has followed OPEC production like slightly more closely, but there, I mean, if you look at the graph, it's still just a huge gulf between the price and the production level. Mm-hmm.
The thing that really stands out for me is that there's a stronger correlation between the price fluctuations and global political events.
All the major inflections of the price happen at the same time as all these major political events, and they've annotated the chart with them.
And on that note, one of the things I did right before we started recording today's episode is I wanted to see what the latest OPEC changes in price are, and I was reading some OPEC news. And there's a very considerable drop that happened just after about midway through June of 2014. So to try and understand what was going on there, I did a quick search for major news headlines, global news headlines in 2014. And it turns out that it had nothing to do with any major advancements in production or anything like that.
Oh, of course not.
At the beginning of June in 2014, of course, Bashar al-Assad was re-elected to his fourth seven-year term.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes more sense that the Syrian regime would be attacked, because at the time it was, I remember Obama stood up and, oh, this is terrible, and Assad needs to go, and Syria bad. And what you see then is 2 weeks later is the collapse in the oil price. It went from $110 a barrel down to something ridiculous like $35 a barrel or something like that.
Yeah.
The entire market bottomed out, and literally the smaller producers like Syria were completely unable to move anything. It was more cost effective for them to sell empty oil barrels than to fill them up with oil and then sell them. The oil barrel itself empty was worth more. So this is how political moves are used to affect price changes specifically, or how from a political perspective, forcing a price change can have yet more political outcomes.
Right.
So, yeah, the two are very closely related.
Yeah. Yeah, so one thing that's weird about in economic theory is, like, Austrians, for example, or anyone that really believes in the subjective theory of value, they get half of the explanation of price correct. So half of the explanation is it is the price that the buyer is willing to pay and the seller is willing to sell at. But then what they conclude from this is that it's based on subjective value, because they completely ignore the fact that there are outside factors that influence the price other than just the intrinsic quality of whatever it is they're trying to sell. And those outside factors matter a lot more than the intrinsic factors of whatever it is they're selling. In certain cases, in some cases, you know, like for, you know, a knickknack or whatever, obviously politics aren't really going to come into it. But for something that is the primary source of energy for almost every country in the world, that is, you know, used to make plastics and all this stuff, obviously politics are going to come into it a lot, especially because, you know, the control of production is very centralized among, you know, a handful of countries. And so the reason that that war and geopolitical events like this influence the price of oil so much is because by, you know, knocking out one of the major oil producing countries, it gives the other oil producing countries more bargaining power to raise the price of oil.
I think another telling example is Venezuela. You know, they embarked on what was essentially the latest socialist experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And when it started looking like this might actually, you know, have some kind of success, because here's a socialist experiment that's backed by large oil reserves. OPEC, the US, and basically the global oil markets outside of Venezuela just said, that's not going to happen. They dropped out the oil price. Venezuela couldn't do anything. The entire Venezuelan economy was predicated on the oil price. Then the economy collapsed, and all the pro-capitalists were like, well, you see, no food on the shelves in Venezuela. Socialism doesn't work.
Right.
So, yeah, like every time I've seen people refer to Venezuela as the failure of socialism, I'm like, no, this is very obviously more...
the failure of an economy based on oil.
Well, there's that. But it's also it's a failure that was deliberately caused by capitalists that want to rationalize and justify the continuation of capitalism.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And there's another recent example of how the how certain economies can live and die by the oil price, because Saudi, for the first time in I don't know how many years, instituted taxes for their population.
Yeah.
So people were living tax-free before because they had so much oil wealth, and the price of oil was enough to not require them to levy taxes on people. But in, what was it, last year?
It's actually kicking in this year, and it's not just Saudi. It's all the GCC nations.
Okay.
So it's Saudi, it's Bahrain, it's the United Arab Emirates. The UAE and Saudi have already started implementing the taxes. Bahrain will be kicking in with VAT by October, November.
See, October, November, we're going to be a libertarian podcast, I'm telling you. You're going to be like, taxes are bullshit, man.
It's
my money. I earned it.
Taxation is theft, bro. Taxation is totally theft. Could someone pass
also,
me the weed,
weed should be legal, man. Okay, so back to the oil price. So the first chart, if you're looking at the notes, maybe it would be good if you're listening to this too, if you can just like open up the notes and then you can kind of follow along. So the first chart with the oil price, first of all, one thing that's interesting about it is that it omits the Iraq war, which is when the price of oil just really started going up and up and up nonstop. But it also applies a deflator to the price, so it adjusts the price for inflation. I'm assuming it's based on 2014 dollars because that's like the magic number that economists love to use, or 2007 dollars maybe. But the next chart that I post is the what's called the nominal price, which is not adjusted for inflation. And you can really see in this chart where the Iraq war happened.
It's kind of obvious.
Yeah, it's like the oil price just shoots up above, like well above any historical level. And then it drops a little bit around 2007, which I think a lot of people probably remember because over here, people were freaking out because, like, 2005, 2006, gas was almost $4 a gallon or something like that. People were like, oh my God, this is crazy. Like, it's going to be the end of fossil fuels. Like, we're all going to be driving electric cars soon. And then the price kind of dropped down and people forgot about it. But then around 2007, it started shooting up again. I'm not sure what happened there.
What did happen in 2007 leading up to 2008? Something happened.
Really major thing that maybe affected the whole globe. Maybe it had to do with like finance or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know. I don't remember anything big happening then.
Yeah.
No. Sorry. I can't help.
Oh well. We'll probably never know. So
I do know I was living off grid at the time, so it's all
okay.
Maybe that's why I don't
probably didn't affect you then.
yeah.
So another thing about this the nominal price chart is you can see there's a very distinct spike around the first Gulf War Desert Storm, and there's another spike around when we went into Afghanistan. And then it drops down until we go into Iraq, and then it just shoots up. So we can get into more detail about oil prices. How do you feel about that, Peter?
I would really like that. I would really like that. I'll be honest, I'm a little bit ignorant on the subject matter.
I was too before I read about it. I learned a lot.
Well, as I've alluded to before on the show, instead of doing research, I let you do the research, and then I ask very, very pertinent and well thought out questions during our episodes.
It definitely helps having someone who hasn't learned all the same shit as me, because then I know what, if something that sounds obvious to me is probably totally opaque to, a listener. So, so thanks for not doing research.
You're totally welcome. One of the things that I'm going to bring up is the fact that in South Africa, the only oil price that ever gets quoted on the news during financial news is Brent crude.
Right.
And it's interesting because Brent crude oil has never been used in South Africa whatsoever. I don't think it's ever touched South African soil.
Yeah. What would you use UAE?
Dubai? I have no, Yeah, I have no idea what we would use. I know that at one point South Africa was turning to Venezuela for oil.
Okay.
But
there's kind of
sure.
a direct line across the ocean, huh?
Yeah. It's a lot easier than bringing it in from, let's say, the U.S.
Right. It's probably closer to the Gulf, though, right?
South Africa to Gulf, South Africa to Venezuela. Venezuela is probably a little bit closer, and okay. with shipping being a better option, it's probably more likely that we saved a lot of money by going to Venezuela rather than OPEC.
Weren't all those rolling blackouts happening around the same time that Venezuela was having big oil problems?
Yeah.
I wonder if those had to do with each other.
A lot of people will just turn around and say that South Africa's rolling blackouts had more to do with the mismanagement of the state-run Eskom, which is the power company that was running everything. And in all fairness,
I don't know, the South African government really has it together. So,
yeah.
Okay. So
back to what we're talking about now. Oil prices. Yeah. Explain them to me nicely.
Okay. Now I'm gonna be very rude about it. Okay. All right. Oil futures began being traded in 1983 when the crude oil market was deregulated.
Wow. So they started gambling on the price of oil the moment that there was no more regulation on the oil market.
Yes. Now quit interrupting me. So it's not clear to me because there's not a whole lot of information about it like available in articles or anything like that. There's a book about how oil futures started, which apparently was like somewhat inadvertent, although I kind of have a hard time believing that. It was probably more deliberate than a complete accident. But... So I'm not sure how oil prices were set prior to this, but I think it was based on spot prices, which is basically what people are currently trading them for. And I'm not sure what the actual act of deregulation was. I was not able to find that. There were a bunch of oil price agreements that kind of set the price of oil at a certain level or restricted oil traders from trading with certain companies. Such as the Red Line Agreement, the Akhenkari Agreement, and so on. And those might have terminated around that time. And one thing I do know is that OECD countries dominated until the rise of OPEC. There was a bunch of oil companies called the Seven Sisters. So prior to oil futures trading, I'm pretty certain it was based on spot prices. Early on in the 1930s, a lot of the world's oil came from Texas. I think probably most of the world's oil was coming from Texas. And in the 1930s, there were major oil discoveries in East Texas. And so that caused a glut of oil production, which caused the price to plunge because, you know, if there's more people selling oil, then each seller has less bargaining power compared to the buyers. So the buyer can negotiate a lower price. And that led to the state militia being called in to handle a conflict over oil prices and oil production. There was an organization called the Texas Railroad Commission, or the Railroad Commission of Texas. I'll just call it the TRC. And at the time, oilmen and the TRC decided to establish quotas for oil production. So they would estimate demand. They would leave a safety margin for new production. So like any discoveries that they wouldn't have control over, they would kind of factor that into their estimate of how much oil would be produced. And then they basically divvied up the amount that they would need to produce in order to meet demand without causing a glut. So that what they didn't want to happen was that they produce too much, and so oil buyers have all the bargaining power. Mm. So basically, they decided to regulate themselves, which is one thing that libertarians are always saying will happen. But I think in this case, they wouldn't want that to be true. They wouldn't want they wouldn't want the idea of capitalists all deciding to limit production on purpose in order to keep the price high to be a thing that would actually happen, because they're always insisting that that's impossible.
Yeah, wouldn't that ultimately, especially since it's not something that it's not a negotiation between buyer and seller.
Right. It's a negotiation between seller and seller. Okay. And that's actually a good example of strategic sabotage, which we'll get to in a second. But so currently, I obviously left out a lot of history because it was just too much to get into. And this isn't an episode completely about oil prices, even though we have been talking about it for like half an hour now. So currently, oil futures can be bought on the New York Mercantile Exchange, otherwise known as NYMEX, the Tokyo Commodity Exchange, TOCOM, and through ICE Futures, which is a futures market. There are different index grades on different exchanges. So there's different grades of oil based on how much sulfur is in the oil. Low sulfur oil is called sweet oil, and more sulfurous oil is called sour. And then also based on the density of the oil. So lower density oil is called light oil. So light sweet crude is probably what most people have heard of. And so that would be a low sulfur, low density oil. And so there's different index grades traded on different exchanges. So the oil futures are, I guess they're probably like averaged out, to the current, an average level at the current point in time. And that's considered an oil index. And so the price of certain grades of oil is used as a benchmark for the sale of all oil. So there's probably, tons of different grades, I'm sure. But there's only a few that people really care about when it comes to what the price of oil is. So the one that Peter mentioned earlier is Brent crude. And that is from the UK. And it's a light sweet crude traded on ICE Futures, which is a British market. I think it's also, I think it's everywhere in Europe, actually. West Texas Intermediate is a light sweet crude from obviously Texas, and it's traded on the NYMEX, the New York Mercantile Exchange. And there's also UAE Dubai crude, which is a medium sour crude, and it's traded on the Dubai Mercantile Exchange. So I think that's the most major index grade for the Middle East.
Okay, so just for interest's sake, I did a little amount of digging into ICE Futures.
Okay.
And I saw a Fortune article where back in 2017, ICE had been named to the Fortune Future 50, which basically determined the top 50 companies that are best positioned to adapt and deliver growth in a complex environment. Yeah. I mean, they were named to the Fortune 500 in 2017, and ICE is the only exchange operator included in the Fortune 500 ranking. So we're not talking about a small, upstart company that's just making waves in the background. This is one of the largest companies on the planet
that trading the most important index grade of oil on the planet.
Exactly. So I mean, if you don't already. I would recommend including ICE Exchange in your Google Alerts or whatever else you use to get regular news updates on whatever platform you get your news
on from. All the political economy stuff that you read all the time.
Exactly.
Us two nerds.
Jesus, if I had to fucking list all the stuff that I follow in order to understand political economy, Jesus Christ. Anyway, so yeah. Keep an eye on ICE Futures because, my God, just for reference sake, I mean, this is a company backed by Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, BP, Total, Shell, Deutsche Bank, Societe Generale. They're not They're not really small great guys. Players in the game. They're not. They own Standard and Poor's securities evaluations.
That's wild. Yeah. It's crazy how much of this shit is in the background. Like, you hear about all these things in business news, and you just, like, you have no idea who controls it, who owns it, you know?
Yeah. The principal backers for ICE essentially were the same financial institutions that were supposedly the most affected by the 2008 economic crisis.
Yeah. And a lot of companies that are descended from, like, literal colonizers.
Yeah.
Like, BP started it as a company to manage the colonization of Iran. So the takeaway from all this, I think, is that, once again, a price is not a signal or a representation of industrial reality. It's purely based on on a strategy to accumulate power. As we talked about in our last episode, the best way to accumulate power that is currently known is to perform capitalization, to value the assets that you can purchase in order to accumulate power based on the expected amount of power that it'll get you in the future. And so that's what is determining the price of oil. It's not based on any production, like reality of production, other than to the extent that it goes into this power process. So again, there is this supply and demand dynamic, but the reason that it matters is because it determines whether the buyer or the seller has more bargaining power in negotiating a price. Which is why I very carefully phrased it that way every time, you know, the supply of oil came up. So, anytime there's a glut and a low price of oil, it's because the buyers had more power to negotiate the price down. And so in response to that, the sellers, who, you know, in the end have the real power because they do own the assets that are being sold, they unanimously opted to regulate themselves in order to prevent any buyers from having more bargaining power than them. Mm. And so that gets us to strategic sabotage. So an important part of capitalization is the strategic sabotage of the social sphere. As Bickler and Nitzan explain, if industry ran at its most efficient, there would be nothing to pay for. This is actually probably the most interesting section in their book. I'm not going to get too much into it because...
It can get quite complex and
yeah, it's kind of complex, and I don't think I would be able to do it justice by summarizing it myself. But they have this concept that they get from Thorstein Veblen called the social hologram, and it's basically the idea that industry is sort of the coincidence of all human sociality. So he distinguishes industry from business. So industry is what humans do, and business is the control over what humans do.
Yeah.
And so that's why I kind of I still haven't found like a really great way to support or rationalize or define this, but I really think that business is a form of statecraft. And, you know, the state is also sort of control over the social hologram.
I mean, technically it can very, well, not easily, but it can be described as a kind of outsourcing of state work.
Right. Yeah, I mean, business is, I don't remember if we ever released the episode. I don't think we did, but... we recorded an episode where we talked about how businesses are sort of like independently formed bureaus of the state. But
I'm sure we did.
I can't remember. Anyway.
Look at us. We're so aware of our own podcast.
Yeah. So Again, if industry ran at its most efficient, there would be nothing to pay for. In other words, there's no way to collect revenue from a social process unless that process is restricted in some way, contingent on quid pro quo for whoever is restricting the process. And I noted here, I hesitate to say payment or remuneration because we have examples like Facebook, which are free ostensibly, but they're also used to collect data on users in order to target ads at them. So you're not paying for Facebook, but you are giving something up to use Facebook, which is your, you know, right to privacy or whatever you want to call it.
Okay. Before we run ahead here, I just want to clarify a thing or two. When you say a social process, can you give a very short description of what is meant by social process?
So that's kind of a problem that I have here, is that I really can't. It's kind of, I don't know. It's something that, yeah, it's kind of vague. It's like, and it just includes so many different things, because we could give the example of like, you know, making a product. That's a really obvious one, you know, weaving cloth, you know, obviously that's a social process because it involves, you know, a bunch of people working together to do something. But it could also be something like meeting in public space. So one thing, I wish I could find this article easily, but there's an article about malls in America and how they've dominated public space to the point where there's no real like town center anywhere anymore. It's all been taken over by malls. And so it's basically the sabotage of the town center, which has turned into this area where you just walk around and, you know, pay money to eat and buy clothes and whatever you do in a mall. I don't know. I don't ever go to malls, so I don't know what the fuck people do there.
Okay, so do you think that from a historical perspective, that a good example of the sabotage of a social process could then be something like the enclosure of the commons?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's probably the example that almost everyone who cares at all about political economy is familiar with. Marx called that primitive accumulation. And Marxists generally view that as, you know, something that happened once at the beginning of capitalism. And now that we have capitalism, we just have like regular accumulation. But in reality, this process of sabotaging the social sphere in order to, you know, collect revenue or other forms of quid pro quo happens constantly. It happens all the time.
I mean, immediately what I think of is on Instagram, there's so many different pages dedicated to following a specific trend, where you'll find that someone in Japan will start the trend of teaching a dog how to do a very specific trick.
Uh-huh.
And soon this catches on, it becomes a trend, and then you find someone capitalizing on
that. Right.
And turning it, finding a way to make it so that no one can do it without paying for the ability to do that.
Yeah.
Another
example would be like, you know, in the early 2000s, Napster was invented. And so people were able to just freely share music. So people took the music that they owned, that they already paid for, and put it up on this file sharing service. And then anyone could just download it for free because you can just copy it as many times as you want. It doesn't degrade the music or anything like that. And, you know, the music industry obviously caught on to this. And then they appealed to the government to make that practice illegal, or to clarify that it was illegal. So they went to court. They, you know, sued a bunch of people, and they kept suing people for these crazy amounts of money, to like make an example of everyone that did it and to kind of scare people out of doing it. And then from there, they used the same electronic networks, the same technologies, and they just invented streaming services. So now you can listen to as much music as you want over electronic networks, exactly as you were doing on Napster. But instead of downloading the file once and then owning it and then listening to it as many times as you want for free, now you pay constantly in order to stream the music to yourself every time you want to listen.
Okay, so I think that in the modern context, that's probably our very best example.
Yeah.
Because music is a very social process.
Yes.
It's. I mean, those who follow me closely on Twitter know that I'm not a huge fan of music as it is, but it's this commercialization of music that really gets to me. It really bothers me. To the point where I find myself unable to enjoy a lot of music. And it's because of this commodification of it that it's bothersome for me. And it's because deep down I feel like music is ultimately about the social processes involved. It's about the jam sessions that you go to with other musicians and if I then record that and someone uploads it and that gets spread for free, surely that should be up to me as part of a collective that made that music. We should then get to dictate what gets done with that music. But because major record companies essentially buy the complete rights to everything that popular artists do, they then get to control how that music is distributed. And there's that whole social process that basically just gets sabotaged.
So pro-capitalists would argue that this process of sabotaging the social sphere, which they would say, of course, is like a ridiculous way to describe it. They would say that the restriction of goods for quid pro quo or for payment is actually what makes an industry efficient, because the prices represent the balanced forces of supply and demand and therefore manage scarcity to its optimum level. However, as we just discussed in the example of the most important price in the world, supply and demand has little, if anything, to do with the price. And of course, that price influences the price of almost probably every single good in the world. And so it's kind of tainted. Even if every good except for oil is determined through supply and demand, there is a huge part of the price in the, you know, the cost of the good that is directly based on not supply and demand.
What's interesting to me is that a pro-capitalist would argue the supply and demand thing, but sort of like completely ignore the fact that even with that argument, even if supply and demand did strongly influence or determine the price of an object, the supplier, by their argument then, higher prices are good.
Right. Well, they would just argue that, okay, sure, but you know, competition. So there's other sellers, and so if you try to set the price high, then someone will just undercut you and profit more than you.
But
that ignores, of course, the cost,
the formation of
the
cartel.
Cost of getting the thing that you're selling. Yeah, well, cartels too, but they have arguments for all that shit. It's like, oh, well, cartels just break down naturally because there's always someone who's willing to break the cartel, cheat on them, and not do that anymore. But
OPEC no longer exists.
What they really ignore and they have no response to is producing a good has a certain cost, and you can only lower the price so much before you are undercutting yourself. You're digging into your own profits. So sellers have a really high interest in maintaining what's called full cost pricing. So they want the price to be a certain margin above what it costs them to make it. So there's certain times where undercutting is absolutely not viable at all. Anyway, so supply and demand have little, if anything, to do with the price of oil. An existing industry could actually technically refine more oil, but I put this in a note and I missed it earlier, but oil refineries only operate at 2/3 of their maximum capacity. So they leave a ton of capacity to meet new demand for oil, but they refuse to produce more because it would give more bargaining power to oil buyers, and so they would lose out on profit.
So technically the capitalists are what are saving us from them destroying the environment and causing runaway global warming.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, even though Exxon covered up their knowledge of global warming for at least 60 years, yes, they're preventing Thank global you. Warming.
yeah. Thanks, capitalists. You're yeah. really doing us a solid.
Press F to give respect to capitalists. the biggest influence supply and demand actually does have on the price, again, is the existence or non-existence of a glut, where buyers and sellers, or where buyers have more power than sellers. So without strategically restricting the flow of oil or access to a durable good or service, capitalists are incapable of extracting revenue from the provision of the good or service. So we could crudely think of this as private ownership of the means of production. But as we covered in our Firmhood episode, which I'm pretty sure we did release.
Yeah, we did.
Ownership of the means of production does not mean control of the revenue generated from the social process. So you can own the means of production, but still lack the capital in order to utilize them and therefore extract revenue from their operation.
Foxconn does not make money off selling iPhones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Foxconn can't make money without a company like Apple coming to them and giving them the capital that they need to produce something.
Yeah. I mean, they make their own profit margins by screwing labor over, but when it comes to the selling of the iPhone, none of the profit that is made from that sale goes to Foxconn. That goes to Apple.
Right. 100%. Right. Yeah, they make the only money that they make is what is negotiated through their contract with Apple. And yeah. Apple has most of the power in determining how much they're going to get paid for what it is they produce. That's why Apple is so profitable, is because they actually because they produce so many iPhones. They're like one of the biggest producers of smartphones in the world, so they can negotiate much lower prices for their phones. And so last I saw, it only cost $20 to produce an iPhone.
And what's it selling for now? Like $600-700?
Yeah. So they're making money hand over fist there.
Yeah, they're not playing around with their profit margins.
Right. So what's really important is the right to appropriate the revenue from a social process, which is usually established through contract, as we mentioned. Excuse me. The power to appropriate revenue depends critically on the ability to prevent someone from doing something without paying. So again, this could be ownership of the means of production, but more commonly, it's ownership of capital. And, the ability to pay someone who does own some means of production produce something for them.
I think even if we were to say means of production here, going back to music as the social process that is the best example of sabotage here, the means of production when it comes to music is technically owned by first and foremost the musician,
right?
But then they then sell the finished product to the record company, who also has some means of production.
And in between them, there's the studio that records them.
Yeah.
They also own means of production. And then, then they sell it to a record company.
But
that
the only
distributes
people,
the music.
Yeah, but the only people that end up making money, that end up taking in a revenue for the streaming of the songs are the major record labels. A little bit of it goes towards royalties. And basically means of production don't matter for shit.
Right. Yeah. And so the sabotage of the social sphere includes not only making you buy products, making you pay for the stuff that you use, but also the ability for you to use your own time freely. So in order for us to survive today, we have to pay for products that keep us alive, keep us healthy, keep us comfortable, and so on. So like if we roll back to the feudal period, most of what keeps you alive is stuff that you produce yourself. So you live on a manor, and you farm rye and turnips and whatever else, and you have a couple coos in the commons, and you survive off of that. So the stuff that keeps you alive is not, you're not buying it from anyone. You're not going down to the market to buy your daily food. That was not the normal reality for a feudal peasant. But today, for a capitalist peasant, we buy everything. Everything is for sale. Unless you can create money, so unless you're a bank or a sovereign government, you have to spend time earning the money that you need to buy stuff to survive. So the more everything costs, and or the less you make from wages or sales or whatever it is you do, the more of your time has to be devoted to revenue generating activities. So by increasing the cost of goods or by lowering wages, capitalists establish more control over your free time and force you into their service, because they at the end control what things you can do to generate revenue for yourself. So to solidify this point of sabotage, let's think about two companies that are competing to each make the same good. Each good is exactly as good as the competitor's good. So who will win this competition? According to neoclassical theory of economics, they will both win because there's perfect competition, and companies are price takers. Prices just sort of materialize from the Newtonian process of balancing supply and demand. And so each company will take an equal share of profits. According to reality, on the other hand, the winner will be the company that's better at doing the business part of business. So marketing the product to buyers, creating revenue sources, acquiring more shelf space in stores, getting better deals on production to reduce costs, bundling it with other things that people buy, smearing their competitors, and so on. It's not a neutral, friendly contest of who makes the better product. It's a highly politicized battle for each business to sucker punch the other and knock them out.
And the only time that it works out even remotely similar to what the neoclassicist would then say with the equal share of revenue is when both companies cut the buyer out of the equation, sit down together and decide on how to screw the buyer over together.
Yeah, that's one instance. The other instance that I would cite is the thing that actually made me think of the idea of price being based on power process, which is how I came upon capitalist power theory, which is the difference between buying a product at a store like Walmart and buying a product in a flea market. So in a flea market, you can actually go there and haggle with the person who's selling the price. And the reason for that is because they're one seller among many in a physical space that is filled with other sellers. They're all really close together. A lot of them sell the same shit. And they're one person, offering to sell to one other person, compared to a store like Walmart, which is a massive company with basically complete dominance over the retail market. And so they just tell you what it is you will pay for their products. You have no way of negotiating with them at all. So the closest thing to the supply and demand explanation that neoclassicists give, the supply and demand, perfect competition, all that shit, is the flea market. So yeah, that would be my example.
Okay. I have to say, here in Bahrain, there's my wife excels at this. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of haggling that happens here.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
Obviously not when you go to the major supermarkets or whatever, but when
it's a classic Middle East pastime, though, right?
Well, it's not so much that. It is ingrained in the culture in that, yep. When the company that I work for, when we sit down for a meeting with someone, before the meeting, my boss will turn to me and say, so like, this is the price that we're going to give them. It's going to be higher than our usual price because I know these people and I know they'll want to push us down on the price. Well, there's going to be quite a bit of negotiating, but this is more or less where we want to end up on our price. So we're going to push it up this much. And like, I hate it, but this is, I've actually experienced where I've gone in at my costed price on how much I need in order to survive. And I've quoted that price and I've been undercut like crazy to the point where it's no longer worthwhile for me to offer my services at all, because I'm not going to be able to survive on the amount that's being offered, because part of the culture here is to negotiate. It's almost considered rude not to. And my wife is fantastic at this. Like, we go into one of the more markety areas where a lot of the stores are very similar to each other. They're very China store kind of next to each other, and they're all selling the same crap. Yep. And because that there's that kind of situation, you go in there and you like ask how much for this belt, and they'll give you a price, and you'll be like, ah, come on. And then they'll bring it down a little bit, and then you'll sort of say, this is my maximum price. And they'll be like, no, you need to give me this much. And like, my wife rocks at this. I'm not going to lie. We've gotten some really good deals thanks to her.
So, a conception. Yeah, we're talking about sabotage. Listen, all y'all. A conception of strategic sabotage has actually been popularized in I guess leftist what word am I thinking of?
Culture?
Yeah, I don't know about culture, like just like common knowledge, I guess, is what I'm trying to think of. But popularized by Naomi Klein with her book Disaster Capitalism, I think that's what it was called. That's what she calls the concept anyway. And her idea is that capitalists seize upon social harms, usually perpetuated by government regimes committed to right-wing ideology, and they seize upon these harms committed by other parties, and they use that to profit for themselves. And so it's sort of this passive conception of strategic sabotage. So far, the way we've talked about it, I think it probably sounds like we're only talking about things that capitalists do themselves, but like with the enclosure of the commons, it was kind of a joint project. But then there's also definitely the possibility of, you know, a government just doing something of its own accord, and then capitalists seeing an opportunity and seizing upon it in order to profit for themselves.
Okay, so just like, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. Is this, for instance, saying capitalism has led to a lot of industrial pollution, which has led to climate change, which has led to increased frequency and ferocity of hurricanes, during which Nestle will up the price of their bottles of water, which then gets applied to relief areas.
Yeah. Or even before you get to the hurricane part, there's capitalism leads to climate change. And there's we see that there's something we need to do about climate change. So you have all these companies seizing upon the desire for people to do something about climate change by offering these green products that don't really do anything better for the environment and don't solve the problem, but they do seize upon that social harm that has already been caused. Yeah, that would be another example. But yeah, I was, when you said, would this be immediately, I was like, hurricanes, yes. that's the example.
Disaster capitalism, got it.
yeah, so that's called disaster capitalism. But, you know, as I alluded to, it can be both passive and active. So examples in the Capitalist Power book that Bickler and Nitzan use of active sabotage include in around the start of the 20th century, there were a bunch of electric rail lines in the U.S. and auto manufacturers who were just starting up decided to buy a bunch of these electric rail lines and just closed or destroyed them. And so that obviously forced people to you know, need some other mode of transportation to get around long distances other than the electric rail lines that are no longer available to them. So they would have to buy cars.
So it's one industry, an entire industry essentially going after any kind of competing industry.
Yeah, that, exactly.
And then just done. It's like people keep telling me, oh, no, but you can totally see the major oil companies. They're the biggest investors in renewable energy. And I'm like, yeah, dude, they're not investing in it so that they can save humanity. They're buying up patents and
and shutting them off from people.
And then that copyrighted stuff now will go on the books, and they might produce it once they run out of a market for oil, and they need to shift. And as your venture capitalists will call it, they need to then pivot. And at that point, I'm like, they're not doing it for humanity. They're doing it to maintain their power.
Right. Yeah. Another example that Bickler and Nitzan use is pushing conflict in oil-rich regions in order to drive up the price of oil, which is then used to finance weapon sales. So they actually cover this very extensively in their book, The Political Economy of Israel. I believe that's where they cover it. And they call this the weapon dollar petrodollar coalition. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically, you know, around the 70s, to really summarize this the briefest way I can. Weapon sales started drying up because of the end of the Vietnam War. So there was no longer a major war that the U.S. was in where they could sell weapons to the U.S. government. And so they had to start exporting weapons to other countries. And initially, the exports were partially financed by the U.S. government, but the budget for that started drying up. And so in order to continue this gravy train of weapon exports, they had to ensure that oil-producing countries like Saudi had enough extra oil wealth to to buy their weapons. And so what they did was they started pushing for conflicts to happen in these energy-rich regions, other than Saudi, of course, which then causes oil-producing countries to be, you know, knocked out from the competition, and it would then allow Saudi to raise the price of oil to get more from oil sales, and then to buy more weapons from them, which then fed back into the conflicts in the energy-rich regions, because of course Saudi finances, you know, all these terrorist groups in the area. And so Bickler Nitzan call war the ultimate act of sabotage. And we could look even further at, say, the Iraq War, where famously, you know, we bombed Iraq to shit and then sent in companies like Halliburton to go and rebuild all the stuff that we blew up. So we sabotaged the country and then, you know, rebuilt it, and capitalists made a bunch of money on doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's neoliberalism 101. Is you bomb the shit out of a country, and then once all its infrastructure is destroyed, you then say to them, well, look, buddy, you need to refinance your entire country. Go to the IMF, go to the WTO, go to the World Bank. The bombed country then goes to the IMF, the WTO, the World Bank. They take out these long-term loans that they will then use that finance to rebuild. But those loans come with stipulations, such as you will use these American corporations to run the rebuilding, and you will give certain resource concessions, and you will whether it's oil, whether it's water, whether it's precious minerals, whatever it is that your country has, this is what you're going to give in order to refinance everything. So not only will we bomb the shit out of you, we're going to extort everything we can out of you so that you can rebuild yourself. And if you don't do that, you're not going to rebuild. And your people are going to suffer for a long time. And of course, in this entire process, these places that now have their power stripped from them, you've got massive power vacuums that then jump up in these areas. And in the case of African nations, those power vacuums are then taken up by warlords. And that just keeps the problem and the crisis situation going for as long as possible. And in the meantime, it's the natural resources are stripped at astronomical rates. So sabotage is a very deep running issue.
Yeah. And so there's a couple of patterns that I identified. This was, I think I did this last night, so it's kind of last minute. I didn't think it all the way through, but there's a lot of common patterns for how sabotage works. One of them is to centralize ownership of a good and then charge for its use as a service. So a really contemporary example of this is the transition to cloud computing, which I'm sure everyone has heard about. So before the current era, if you were going to host a large application, I would say in the 90s, what you would do was you would buy a bunch of servers, you would run them yourself, you would hire, you know, IT people or, you know, people to manage your servers, and then you would run the application usually on premises or, you know, on some other site. Then it became more common to for business to offer web hosting, so they would take care of all of the management of the server themselves, and they would just charge you like per server, or you know, you could get what's called a dedicated server, which is where you're the only person using a given machine, or you could buy a shared server, and so you would just get, you know, you would coexist on one server with a bunch of other people, and you would all just pay, you know, I think for my server that I pay for, which is shared, I pay like $18 a month or something like that. And so you would just, you know, pay for a month or a year or whatever. And today, what we have is cloud computing, where one huge massive company like Microsoft or Amazon or Google will run just incredibly huge server farms, and they would all be running this specialized operating system. So instead of like Windows Server, they run Windows Azure. And so when you use Windows Azure, instead of paying for a server or, you know, paying a monthly subscription to run on one of their servers with other people, you pay for what's called Azure credits. And so it's this completely abstract notion of you get some measure of computing power. And so once you, like, as your app runs, you use up Azure credits based on how much of the computing resources they allocate to you you use. And so you could actually, if you pay for a certain amount of Azure credits, but you use too much of the computing resources, you could actually run out of credits, and then your site goes down before the end of the month. And so you have to pay for more credits. And they also have for database servers, which, you know, for just about any web application, you're going to have a database server. So you not only are paying for Azure credits, you're also paying for what's called a DTU, a data transfer unit. And so you get a SQL server that is like 10 DTUs, and it will either, I'm still not sure how this part works, because I just learned about this little bit of it like a week or two ago, but it either slows down your like the speed of the database, so the performance of the database is restricted to a certain level, or I think that's what it is. It doesn't run out like credits do, but if your application is performing too slowly, then you have to pay for a higher DTU tier, and so you pay them more to use more computing resources. Whereas like on the server that I'm hosted on, they don't care how much storage you use. You get, you know, X amount of memory, and you can use as much of it as you want. There's no limit to the amount of bandwidth that you use. So, you know, all the listeners can download the podcast as many times as they want, and, you know, I still pay the same price, and it doesn't like run out or anything like that. The only thing that's really limited is the performance, which is only because I'm sharing the server with other people. And so if their application is using a lot of computing resources, then it'll slow down mine, and vice versa. But the price doesn't go up or down. So by centralizing the ownership of servers to an incredibly high degree, where, you know, we're heading towards almost all servers in the Western world being owned by three companies, they can really abstract everything about the process of using the server, and they can just sort of charge whatever they want. So that's one pattern. Another common pattern is for a capitalist to insert themselves as a middleman for buying something, and then just freely buying it, you know, as much as they can on behalf of the seller, so that the price starts to balloon above what anyone could afford without going through that middleman. So a really good example of this is student lending in the U.S. So, you know, in the like 50s and 60s and so on, college was affordable by someone working a minimum wage job for, you know, regular full-time hours. Whereas today, you know, it costs at least like $10,000 a year or $10,000, sorry, a semester to go to college. And so you come out of college with in thousands and thousands of dollars of debt. No, I guess it is per year. But anyway, so the reason for that is because they started offering loans to go to schools, and those loans were backed by a federal loan guarantee. And so the government would back the loans so that you could essentially get them as unsecured loans, and so you could take on as much debt as you wanted, because they don't care. Like, you're the one who's going to be liable for it, and student loan debt is very, very collectible, so they can just garnish your wages if you don't pay it back to them. And so because of this, the schools knew that they could just start charging more and more for tuition, and so the cost of going to college started ballooning, and now it's utterly impossible, unless you're a rich person, to go to school without taking out loans or without getting, you know, full ride scholarship.
I'm just flabbergasted. I didn't quite understand how the education system in the U.S. Had been taken over this way, but
yeah.
And then you go across the pond and you end up in Finland, where education is so free and so advanced that they pay you to go to college.
Yeah, exactly.
And they have some of the greatest outcomes because their system is not it's not the same exam style system that is you have in the U.S. and like it's all just better. Like,
right.
The actual outcomes of education are better. And just judging by Twitter, I have to say education in the U.S. is having some really bad effects.
Another example of this middleman strategy is health insurance in the U.S., which is another extremely, extremely fucked up system that does not exist anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, everyone else in the world, here, let us set up free healthcare because we understand that healthcare is an investment in society. In the U.S., well, see, we're going to give you free access to health insurance because we understand that investment in healthcare insurance is an investment in capitalism.
Well, you're almost right, because prior to the ACA, you didn't even have free access to health insurance, because if you had any sort of disease, they would be legally allowed to just decline giving you insurance at all. But so the way that insurance worked is like the basic way that insurance works is insurance companies bet on them taking in more in insurance premiums than they pay out in insurance benefits. So,
yeah, it's essentially let the payments of the many cover the costs of the few.
Right. And so what ended up happening with health insurance here is your insurance company will just pay for whatever stupid shit the doctor wants to do, whether or not it's necessary. And of course, doctor's offices and hospitals have a very strong interest in selling as much shit as possible, whether or not it's actually necessary, because then they make more money. So they were giving people, MRIs and CAT scans and all these super advanced medical technology things that people really didn't need. You go in for a head cold and you get a CAT scan or whatever.
You stubbed your toe? Come.
Yeah.
The MRI is this way.
Right. And so what ended up happening was, it increases the cost of healthcare, and as that cost ratchets up, because of course prices never come down, then it becomes completely unaffordable to anyone who doesn't have health insurance. Mm. And that further allows the health insurance companies to charge more for premiums, because who else are you going to get healthcare from?
Yeah, no, sorry, sucks.
Yeah.
Like, I've told you before about my Freestyle Libre, which is
Oh, yeah, the diabetes thing.
Yeah, it's a diabetic patch that I put on my arm.
Uh-huh.
here and in Europe and in Africa and in the Far East and I think South America as well, the chip literally lasts 2 weeks, and then you have to take the patch off and you have to put it on the other arm. And so you'll use two of these in a month. And it's not cheap, but it works out more or less the same price as it would cost you to do the finger prick tests and the test strips for that. So, I mean, for the same price as the traditional glucometer, it's a lot more effective, and I can test myself 1,000 times in a day. The same item was finally okayed by the FDA about 4 or 5 months ago,
uh-huh.
And with one caveat. Caveat.
Caveat.
I'm South African. I pronounce things the way I pronounce things. this caveat was essentially, in America, it's only allowed to last a week.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So your American version, if I were to go and visit the US, my medical costs would literally double at a minimum. That's not even taking into account the fact that the cost of one of these patches in the US versus here is double what I pay here. So if I were to go and visit the US for, let's say, 3 months, my medical cost for those 3 months would quadruple instantly.
Yeah.
That's so, yeah, your healthcare system is terrible. The cost of your insulin is more than pretty much anywhere else in the world. And I come from Africa, people. it may be South Africa, which is like Africa light, but even in South Africa, I mean, here the insulin it's quite expensive. But back in South Africa, I was getting my insulin on a monthly basis from the government at like it would cost me whatever it cost me to register for the month with the state hospital, which worked out to like 20 rand a month, which is like less than a dollar.
Yep.
So.
Okay. So the last one that I have here, it's kind of a more general version of the previous pattern that I mentioned, which is where the social sphere is restructured in order to make everyone more dependent on a product or service that capitalists provide. So we already talked about the auto companies buying up electrical rail lines and closing or destroying them, which made cars more necessary. We could also cite the example in the like 70s leading up to today of sprawl in urban and suburban space. So, you know, before the modern era, you either lived in the city or the country. There was no really such thing as a suburb. But today, the suburbs are probably the majority of space where people live. And in suburbs, everything is, first of all, there's no like grid street pattern, at least in the US. It's all the subdivision pattern, which is just completely irrational. You know, streets going nowhere, cul-de-sacs everywhere. Roads are curved and kind of meet up with each other in nonsensical ways. And that makes it much harder to travel around, especially on foot, because in order to get anywhere in a reasonable amount of time, you would have to like cut through people's yards and have fun trying to do that. And then everything is farther apart. And so it makes cars more necessary. It also actually makes healthcare and like exercise gyms more necessary because the subdivision model can be directly associated with rates of obesity and health issues because people are unable to walk, so they're not getting exercise in their normal daily activity. They have to drive everywhere, and so it causes health issues. So
yeah.
Another example would be the modern design of buildings with very high ceilings, without things like transoms, and without much ceiling, with large windows. all these things contribute to requiring more HVAC, especially the latter, the AC part. So, you know, prior to the mid 20th century, obviously air conditioning did not exist, and somehow we all got by, and that's mainly because buildings were designed to be, you know, cool in the summer months. But thanks to the incredibly inefficient designs that we have for buildings today, AC is all but a requirement for just about any building in most climates.
And then, also just on a related note, I don't know if you remember this article, but there's a very, very good article that, that basically explains that Reagan could never have become president if it wasn't for air conditioning.
Yeah, because of the migration to the South, right?
Yeah.
And the last example I have here is domestic de-skilling. In other words, the loss of knowledge on how to prepare food, to you know, perform basic domestic tasks, essentially, to like to garden. But I think the best example is food preparation, where a lot of people today, including many people that I'm friends with, have just no fucking idea whatsoever how to cook.
Jesus, I'm coming across it so often, and it pisses me off.
Yeah. Like, so like if, this would be like a death sentence. This would be a death sentence in, you know, prior to the modern era. But today, since we buy everything at the store, it's actually a boon to capitalists, because then they sell you the pre-made meals where you don't need to be able to know how to cook. But they also charge you much more for it, not only because of the labor that goes into preparing the food, but also because what alternative do you have? And another thing
that fast food.
Yeah. And another thing that goes into the demand for pre-made meals and fast food, as Peter just said, is that colonization of time that I mentioned earlier. So a lot of people do know how to cook, but because they spend so much time trying to get money to live and, you know, taking care of their family and shit like that, they don't have time to cook. And so they have to go for those pre-made meals. And that's part of the whole it costs more money to be poor idea.
Yeah.
So we're running pretty long. I think we're more to cover, basically, but we're going to skip over it for now.
Well, I think we'll leave it for either an episode on its own. I remember we discussed this during the week. Next time on Capital is Power, we will be discussing...
I think we should just do a whole episode. The next section was going to be about neoliberalism, but you know, it's such a popular topic that I think we should just have a whole episode about it.
Yeah, it's not just a popular topic. It's an important topic when discussing capital as power.
Yeah.
Because it has become the dominant form of wielding power under capitalism in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. So, yeah.
Yeah. So that was Capital is Power Part 2. If you managed to listen to this entire episode without listening to Part 1, we recommend listening to that as well. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Podcast Addict, whatever app you use for Android, because there's a million of them. We also have a website, postscarcitymagazine.com. That is where we host the show and where we have the show notes available. So if you want to look at any of those charts we were talking about, or if you want to read ahead to the neoliberalism section, you're welcome to do that too. For the Capital's Power series, I'm putting it all in the same document. And I will separate it out by saying, you know, episode 2. Let's see. We are on Twitter at NeighborSciPod, Facebook.com/NeighborScience. What else? We have a Patreon, Patreon.com/NeighborScience, as I mentioned before. We have outtakes on there. I will try and get the rest of those up this weekend, I guess.
Also check out our Instagram page where we toss up all our cover art and any memes that we make during the week to just like keep our Twitter account active. Go check those out. I take great pride in my skills in creating beautiful artwork. And then when Ryan creates beautiful artwork, I refuse to let him put it up because he creates very, very beautiful artwork that is very problematic for me living in the Middle East.
Yeah.
I think that's all of it. Ryan is Handle of Rye, at Handle of Rye without an E at the end.
Yep.
And I am at Bookcheekite. Check us out on Twitter and we will chat to you next week.
Bye.